dedicated tonight, our last show for until we get back on in July, is to the members of the USS Liberty. The citation we will read tonight is that of the skipper of the ship of the USS Liberty, Captain William L. McGonigal. The citation was a Congressional Medal of Honor. The citation reads as follows. For conspicuous gallantry and intrepidity at the risk of his life, above and beyond the call of duty, sailing into international waters, the Liberty was attacked without warning by jet fighter aircraft and motor torpedo boats, which inflicted many casualties among the crew and caused extreme damage to the ship. Although severely wounded during the first air attack, Captain McGonigal remained at his battle station on the badly damaged bridge and with full knowledge of the seriousness of his wounds, subordinated his own welfare to the safety and survival of his command. Steadfastly refusing any treatment which would take him away from his post, he calmly continued to exercise firm command of his ship. Despite continuous exposure to fire, he maneuvered his ship, directed his defense, supervised the control of flooding and fire, and saw of the care of the casualties. Captain McGonigal's extraordinary valor under these conditions inspired
varied
members of the Liberty crew, many of them seriously wounded, his heroic efforts to overcome the battle damage and keep the ship afloat. Subsequent to the attack, although in great pain and weak from loss of blood, Captain McGonigal remained at his battle station and continued to command his ship for 17 more hours. It was only after the rendezvous of the U.S. destroyer that he relinquished personal control of the Liberty and permitted himself to be removed from the bridge. Even then, he refused much-needed medical attention until convinced that the seriously wounded among his crew had been treated. Captain McGonigal's superb professionalism, courageous fighting spirit, and valiant leadership saved his ship and many lives. His actions sustained and enhanced the fine tradition of the United States Naval Service. Captain McGonigal presented the Congressional Medal of Honor. Tonight, our guest is Lloyd Paint. Lloyd Paint. Lloyd, are you there?
Yes, I am. It's Lloyd Painter. Yes, I am.
Okay, I just went off the... Okay, you're right, Lloyd Painter. Lloyd, before I forget, what was your rank at the time you were on the ship?
Lieutenant Junior Grade.
Lieutenant Junior Grade. Well, we've got... It never seems to... We have enough time to cover everything we need to cover when it comes to the Liberty. But we've had... this is actually our fourth show with members of the USS Liberty. I'm going to try and do as much as I possibly can in the future also with the USS Liberty. But some of the things that weren't covered was a timeline of all the chain of events. And yet, from what I understand, you were actually on the... what do you call the bridge?
Yes, the bridge.
The Marines should know that, right? Why don't we kind of take it from that time you're sitting up there on the bridge? What time of the day was that?
Well, it's probably easier to understand if we start maybe that morning on June 8th, 1967. I had been assigned the duties of the bridge watch between the hours of 12 noon and 4 p.m. And earlier that morning, I had been down below in my doing my regular duties when I had heard some of the sailors and officers speaking about the ship being overflown. So I had gone up to the bridge on a couple of occasions between 8 and noon that morning and observed the Israeli flying boxcar aircraft slowly circling our ship and waving at our sailors.
I have to ask
this
you,
Storm David clearly marked on the ship. Well, that made us all feel very good that day because the Israelis were our allies and we were in international waters. The last six I took put us about 17 miles at sea, well into international waters. So anyway, at 12 noon, I assumed the watch on the bridge, and during that particular 1 hour between 12 and 1, we had another overflight by the Israeli flying boxcars. These were these
low-lying. Lloyd, I got a question for you.
Yes,
what exactly is a boxcar?
It's a slow moving aircraft, two motors, very slow. I'm not sure the exact designation. They were fondly called flying boxcars. They were actually surveillance aircraft, very slow moving.
Was it a two prop job, a single?
I believe that they had two or either four. Probably two. Two of two motors, two props.
Okay, what I'm getting at here is that the aircraft was flying fairly slow to be able to identify that it was an American ship.
Well, of course. There's no doubt in anyone's mind that was there that day that they could not have identified us as an American ship. We were flying our flags. Our ship was plainly marked, and all that one had to do was go to Jane's Fighting Ships, the official book on all naval vessels of the world, and look our ship up. It would have probably taken 3 minutes to determine who we were.
So let's go ahead and move on.
Between 12 and 1 p.m., I was on the bridge, and it was a beautiful sunny day. You could see forever, a beautiful day in the Mediterranean. And the officers were sunbathing on the forward deck and the enlisted on the aft deck, and I could look right down on the officers sunbathing between 12 and 1. At the same time, this slow-moving reconnaissance aircraft had been moving over the ship. So plainly visible to the pilots were our crew sunbathing. So at 1 o'clock, I'm going to use regular time instead of Navy time, not to get people confused, but at 1 o'clock...
That works.
The captain came up after lunch. He'd been sunbathing, and he decided to call a general quarters drill, which meant we all went to our battle stations. And what happened in my particular instance, my battle station was down on the mess deck level, which was just above the waterline and several levels down from the bridge. So I had to leave the bridge area when he called the drill, and I was relieved by a senior officer who was designated as the officer of the deck during a general quarters drill. And so I went down below to the mess deck, and then my particular job down there was a damage control officer, as well as the mess deck area was designated a casualty collection center. And I stayed down there for about 45 minutes waiting for the drill to be over, and when it was over, I returned back to the bridge, probably putting the time of my return to the bridge about 1:45, at which time I had noticed on the radar scope that our ship was that we had three surface vessels approaching our ship at quite a distance at that point, maybe 12-15 miles out. I'm not sure exactly, but they were pretty far out. But three of these vessels, surface vessels, were had a steady bearing decreasing range, which means basically they are headed straight at us. And I had notified the captain of that, and as the 2 o'clock hour approached, the captain was on the bridge, and he looked out and said something to the effect that there's jet aircraft, and then he said something like, I think they're going to attack. And at that point, I looked out the forward porthole of the ship, and At that point, I was looking straight down the barrel of these jets as they were coming in for the kill. They fired rockets and napalm at the top side of the ship, which set the bridge in an inferno of shrapnel and smoke. And probably, I may be the only one. I was wounded there, but not badly. But many of the people around me severely wounded, and many were killed at that instant. But the attack started shortly, approximately 2 p.m. And so again, the captain at this point, he yelled out general quarters, and this is not a drill, which meant we went to our battle stations for real. So at this point, I went down below decks to the mess deck area where my battle station was. And I remember thinking how glad I was to get out of that bridge area, because it was really horrible, because the jets were concentrated on the bridge, trying to kill everyone and everything in the bridge area.
Wait, a quick question.
Yeah, go ahead.
When you say you were looking out the portal and you're looking down the gun barrel, was there one aircraft or?
Oh no, there were. I'm not sure of the numbers, because they came in waves. And the ways, these were French-built Israeli Mirage and Mystery jets. The first group to hit were the Mysteries. They were very fast. They came in. We took about 820-some rockets topside from the jets. And then the Mysteries, a little bit slower, came in and napalmed the bridge and the topside, trying to kill everyone that was on topside.
Incredible. So what happened when you went down to General Quarters and you took your position?
Well, when it happened on the bridge, when all hell broke loose, I looked all around and I saw people dead, dying, limbs missing, whatever you can imagine. And I think I was probably numb at that point, and training took over, because I went to the officer who was designated as the officer of the deck for general quarters, and I asked him if he would relieve me. And little did I know that he was near death with shrapnel wounds, and he looked at me and said something like, "I don't think I can." And at that moment, the captain relieved me and sent me down to my battle station. And on the way down, three or four levels in the ship, I witnessed several of the sailors in terrible shape, blown to pieces. The sailors that were trying to fight some of the fires from the napalm were fired upon by the aircraft and killed. Anyway, I made it down to my best deck area, and we probably had... Well, we had dozens of tables down there where the crew ate. And during the training, I never thought much about the casualty collection center aspect of that job that I had. But as the dead, dying, and the severely wounded started to come down in stretchers, we used the tables as a makeshift bed. Most of our tables were filled with bodies and gravely wounded sailors. We had one doctor on board, and he ran from one to the next, and I assisted him as much as I could. I watched many people die. We just didn't have enough medical personnel. We had one doctor who did a heroic job, but when you have that many folks hurting, I think at one point we had 172 wounded and 34 dead out of a ship's crew of 280. So if you do the math, you can realize that there weren't a whole lot of people that weren't hurt or in worse shape than being hurt, maybe dead. But anyway, the scene down below in the mess decks at that point was one that was surreal for me, because most everybody I knew, and I assisted the doctor on several of his operations, if you can call them that. We were just doing whatever we could and watched many of the sailors die right there on the table. I also watched the executive officer die, who was a very close friend of mine.
Were this somebody that you went in with, or somebody that you became friends with during your tour?
No, the executive officer, when I got assigned to the ship about 14 months prior to the attack, he and I became, for whatever reason, very close friends, and I became close friends with his family. And I was a bachelor, and he had a whole lot of kids, and so I was always over at their house for dinner. And he was a very close friend of mine, not only my boss, but a very good friend. And he passed away on the mess deck tables. And there was so much of that going on at that point down there that it was actually surreal for me. I just couldn't believe it. And then somewhere around, maybe 2:35 or 2:40, we got word from the bridge that... stand by for a torpedo attack. And at this point, I was probably at the water level. And when that word came down, I think everyone in there just froze and waited. And later we learned that they shot the motor torpedo boats that had come in on us, had fired five torpedoes, and they only hit us with one. But anyway, what had happened is the surface contacts that I had seen on the radar earlier were actually motor torpedo boats on their way out to sink us. The jet aircraft came in first to destroy the top side of the ship, which was mainly it was designed to get all of the sailors and all of our antennas, so we could not transmit any distress calls. And so when I was down below waiting for the torpedo, It was an eerie thing. It was just silent. The ship at this point, we were still moving through the water, but it just seemed like time stood still there for a second. And then when the torpedo hit, the ship went up in the air, drastically up in the air, and then came crashing back down, and then stabilized. And what it feels like when you get hit with a torpedo like that, the best analogy that I could ever think of was like a roller coaster ride. When you hit the top of a roller coaster, go down real fast, your stomach kind of comes up in your throat. And once we went up and came down and stabilized at a very, very drastic list, I'm not sure the degree, but maybe 45 degree list of the ship, because we'd taken in tons of water when the torpedo came in. Of course, all the power went off and the emergency lights flickered on. And here we were with all these people, the dead, dying, and wounded on these tables, and some had been knocked off the tables. And here we were with emergency lights flickering on and smoke and debris everywhere, waiting for the ship to sink. And as we sat there, minutes went by. It's probably more like seconds, but they seem like minutes or maybe even hours. And the ship didn't sink. And so the next phase of it was we began to hear things coming through the ship, kind of like a whizzing noise as these motor torpedo boats that had come up alongside. They didn't sink us. I guess they were out of torpedoes. But they were shooting armor-piercing projectiles, 50-caliber projectiles through the ship.
Now, you were down in the at the water level where you were located, right?
Right.
So you're telling me that these rounds were coming through that area?
The rounds were coming through everywhere I was there. It was like sitting in the living room and somebody was shooting a high-powered rifle or an automatic weapon through your living room. They were going through all the walls and bulkheads. And so everybody, cowered down as best you could. And I do truly believe the motor torpedo boats were attempting to kill anyone that survived, plus hoping maybe to hit our boilers, which would have sent the cold water into the hot water, and we would have gone down in a few minutes. But as it is, they may have hit some sailors with their projectiles. I don't really know, because everybody was wounded already. So if somebody else got another wound from one of these, I'm not sure. But anyway, I was crouched down behind the enlisted men's serving area, where they would pick up their trays and move them along and get their food. Well, underneath that were hundreds of Navy coffee mugs. And I had crouched down behind that, and I remember this huge explosion in front of me, and dust and smoke and glass. And I looked down, and literally one inch from my heart, was a spent projectile that had spent itself in those big coffee mugs as it came through. And I remember reaching in, out, picking it up, putting it in my pocket. I still have it today, by the way. And I just went on with my duties, and it seemed like after a period of time they stopped the firing of the armor-piercing projectiles through the ship. Then word came down from the bridge, prepare to abandon ship. And the word prepare simply means prepare. It doesn't mean abandon. So my job as the officer in charge in that particular compartment was to get the wounded and dead and dying as best I could up a ladder, out onto the main deck, and over to our life raft, where we would wait the final word, abandon ship. So I went up the ladder, and I looked out, opened the hatch, and I looked out, and I saw one of the motor torpedo boats, the Israeli Defense Forces motor torpedo boats with a Star of David on the hull, methodically machine gunning one of our life rafts that had been cut loose. And what had happened with the life rafts, many of them had caught fire from the napalm, and we cut them loose and they were floating back behind us in the water. And the motor torpedo boat was coming up and machine gunning to make sure there was no living body on that life raft. I do believe that's a direct violation of the Geneva Convention. But anyway, that occurred. I witnessed that with my own eyes. And at that point, I think I realized that maybe I wasn't going to go home that day. But anyway, I went back down, made a decision to leave the men where they were, because if I'd taken them up, they would have been machine gun on the main decks, and there were no life rafts anyway for them to enter into.
So we went back down. Had every intention of sinking the ship.
Pardon me?
It sounds like they had every intention of sinking the ship.
Well, it was premeditated murder. They came out early in the morning, overflew us, identified us, came back to kill us. In a criminal court of any sort, that's premeditated murder. So this was definitely a premeditated attack.
Well, anyway, I thought about it in those exact words, but you are 100% correct.
Well, if you were there, you would know that it was premeditated. There's just absolutely no question about it. So what happens is one of our chief petty officers, and now at this point, after the strafing of the jets, the napalming of the jets topside, all of our communications antennas were gone. And we couldn't communicate out to notify anyone that we were under attack. And so finally, we had gotten some word off that we were under attack, but then the equipment went down, and then one of the chiefs got an emergency transmitter up, and he broadcast out on the international distress frequency that we were being attacked by the Israeli Defense Forces. And the reason we didn't know who was attacking us initially was that the jets that came in had the Star of David painted over. They were unmarked. So the first waves that came through, we had no idea who was attacking us. So the initial reports that we got off the ship that we were under attack went out that we were being attacked by unidentified aircraft. It wasn't until the motor torpedo boats came in for the kill that we saw the Star of David. And that's when our chief got the message out that we were under attack by the Israeli Defense Forces. Now, when this message went off the ship, everyone in the world copied the international distress frequency, which meant everyone in the world knew who was attacking us. Mysteriously, the attack ended at that point. And which is the most mysterious thing about this is that the attack ended around 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And we had also made contact with our fleet. They knew what had happened, and yet aircraft that were sent initially to assist us when we had notified the fleet that we were being attacked by unidentified aircraft, they had been returned, and a second group had been sent out to assist us, second group of jet aircraft, and those were recalled, and we sat dead in the water, basically, from 4 o'clock in the afternoon until about 7 o'clock the next morning. That's like 13 hours with dead and dying sailors on board on a ship that was ready to sink at any moment with no help from anyone.
That is just so hard, incredibly hard to... I mean, it's unbelievable, really. It's unbelievable.
Well, I would think that if we had a North Korean fishing vessel in trouble, we would get to them faster than they got to us.
Well, back a little bit when you said... when that torpedo hit and the ship actually came out of the water. You know, you've got three pictures on your website. For those of you who want to go to their website, USSLiberty.org. When you look at it, the ship from the water line, it only looks like by the size of the picture, about a 6 or 7 foot hole. But below the water line, as the ship was uprooted, kind of give me an idea how big that hole was. I mean, it looks like you could park a bus in there.
When we got into dry dock, we actually took that ship. I'll answer that in a second. I'll bring you up to...
Yeah, sure.
Let's go to Malta from where we are. The next morning, the 6th Fleet arrived with assistance, and we got the dead, dying, wounded, and everybody off the ship. Of course, I was one of the lucky ones that got to take the ship across the Mediterranean. We limped across the Mediterranean with tons of water, torpedo hole from the keel, to 6 or 8 feet above the waterline. I can't remember the dimensions. I'm going to say 30 by 40 foot hole, something like that.
Huge.
But anyway, we got it into dry docks into Malta, and then we emptied the water out of it, out of the dry docks, and we could see the extent of the damage. It was horrendous. It went down and destroyed the keel of the ship. The ship was later mothballed and sold to for scrap metal. It was totally useless. But anyway, it was a huge hole. It came in and took out, I think, 24 men died instantly there. And some of the bodies we never found. They floated out to sea. And some were trapped in the cables and steel that had been ripped apart with the torpedo blast. But anyway, we get to Malta, and this is a part of the story that always is in, I thought was always, at the time I didn't understand what was going on. At the time I really didn't know what to make of this whole thing. But we got into Malta, and they brought in the Maltese workers. And I don't know how much this cost the American taxpayers, but they came in, the Maltese workers, and they patched 800 some holes on the outside of the ship, patched each one of them, beautifully little patches. Then they came in and they completely patched the torpedo hole, painted the whole ship in like 2 days. They brought 200 or 300 workers on board. They painted the whole ship, and we looked like $1 million. Unless you look real close and could see all the little patches.
That is, yeah, in the close-up pictures, you can see those little square patches.
That's right. And by the way, most of the photos that you see, I took.
Really?
I took my camera and took most of the pictures right after the attack and all the way through to Malta. But the what amazed me was then they told us we had to take this back to Norfolk, Virginia. So when we were attacked and torpedoed, we put into place the emergency destruction bill on the ship, and we destroyed everything. We destroyed radar, you do that because you don't want it to fall into the enemy hands or whatever. So our ship was totally destroyed, not only by the Israelis, but by us. And so when we left Malta to cross the Atlantic to come back into Norfolk, we had nothing but a motor and a steering wheel, to put it very bluntly. So they had to give us a fleet tug to take us across the entire Atlantic and to bring us into Norfolk, and so that we could come in for the television cameras like nothing ever happened.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and when we got there, what had happened in Malta, since I was the senior officer that had from the security spaces that had the top secret clearance, it was my job to collect all of the classified equipment that we had on board, and where the torpedo hit, it destroyed almost all of our classified equipment. The parts were the parts were everywhere. So anyway, my job was to collect all this stuff and report back to the Navy the extent of the loss, etc. Well, it was such a big job that the only thing we could do was to scoop up the parts and put them in huge, about 20 foot by 3, maybe 3 foot diameter canvas bags that we had made, Maltese made for us. We just shoveled it in, and then at the end we just tied it up so that they were like big, huge balloons full of pieces of equipment. Well, when we got back to Norfolk, Virginia, there was about a half a dozen of these huge bags, and they weighed, they probably weigh close to a ton each, or at least 1,000 pounds, very heavy canvas bags. And they sat on the main deck, and as the sun and the hot summer there in Norfolk, they began to stink a little bit because they began to have a terrible odor. Because in the scooping up of the parts, we scooped up body parts also. And then they sat there, and I tried to get the Navy to let me off the hook as far as being responsible for the missing equipment. They just wouldn't let me sign anything off, so I had to keep these bags on the ship. And then one day an admiral came on board for a tour, and he said, "What are these bags?" And I told him the story. He said, "They'll be gone tomorrow." So the next day I was ordered to take them to the Norfolk Naval Base incinerator and destroy them. And I remember thinking that I cremated a lot of sailors that day, because not only were there parts to our equipment, there were body parts in those bags. And then, of course, I was a bachelor. I knew all of the officers and their families, and many of the chiefs and their families. And so my job was to take the widows to pick up the personal effects of the deceased husbands And I was pretty emotionally drained when this whole thing was over.
Well, I just don't know what to say, Lloyd. I have never heard anything so...
Well, I can tell you one thing you will not find. You will not find this mentioned in any of our history books. It's been deleted from everything. I picked up a book not long ago with the Medal of Honor winners, and even our Captain's Medal of Honor is not listed.
Can you imagine?
We have been taken away from history.
Well, you know, one of my big pushes, number one, is once we get the show back on the air and other things and the first thing that has to happen is the Captain McConnell's CMH have to be entered with the rest of them. The fact that they're treating you, the entire USS Liberty crew, like they're some foreign navy or something, it's just incredible to me. Incredible.
Well, you don't, when you, as the years went by and you could kind of piece together what happened, I think we were expendable that day. I think we were sent there not to come home. And we'd had the Gulf of Tonkin incident a few years before that. It was a similar kind of situation where the North Vietnamese allegedly attacked one of our ships, and based on that, we augmented the war in Vietnam.
Right.
And I think that our president at the time, Lyndon Baines Johnson, had something similar in mind for us. And I cannot believe that the Israelis would have ever acted alone on this. They must have had some sort of a green light, or at most a yellow light, from our government to do this. And what basically was happening, when we were attacked, our military, our Navy forces, believed that we were being attacked by the Egyptians. In those years, the Egyptians were backed by the Russians. This was the middle of the Cold War. And it could have been Johnson's desire to start the war at that time when he felt we were stronger than the Russians, and simply by blaming the sinking of our ship onto the Egyptians, hence the Russians. And we may have had a World War III at that point, but we didn't sink, and we got messages off, and so then Phase 2 or Plan 2 had to be put into action, and that meant to make sure none of us ever said a word about it. And you have to understand, back in the 60s, most of the sailors and the old sailors and officers were World War II people. And when they told you something, you never questioned it. There was no CNN or Fox News to come in and get the story straight and put it to the American people. The American people never learned of this at once. It came out in bits and pieces. It started with there were two or three wounded, there were two or three dead. Finally, it built up to, you know, the amount. But by that time, it was old news. It was just kind of let out in bits and drabs to the people through the newspapers. So our people really never knew the extent of it. And, of course, then the silence was clamped onto it, and our people today still don't know. I'll be willing to bet you that anyone that's in the workforce today, that was they were so small at the time or not even born, that they've never heard of this. And you know, shows like yours, you know, help, but it's not in the history books, and I can go on and on about the way it's been, the cover-up has been attempted. For instance, the BBC did an excellent documentary on this Liberty incident a couple years ago, and they did thorough research. They came here to my home, California, and interviewed me, and it was one of the most truthful documentaries on the Liberty I had ever seen. Well, it was banned in the United States. It was never shown here. It was shown around the world. In Canada, it won an award, I think, at the Canadian Film Festival, and then it went over to Cannes, and it didn't place over there, I don't believe, but it was a very well-done documentary shown around the world, but not here.
What was the name of that?
Operation Cyanide, I believe, is the name of the hold on a second here.
There's another one called
the book that came out of the video is called Operation Cyanide, and it's by Peter Hunnam, and it's, you can get it on online. You can order that book. The The BBC documentary was, Dead in the Water, it was. That was the name of it.
Yeah, Dead in the Water. That's it.
Yeah, and it's excellent, but it was never shown. And you can see the influence that that's brought to bear on our media. A prior one to that, the History Channel did one on the Liberty. They interviewed me, and at the end of the documentary, they brought in. Well, at the end, when the documentary was ready to be shown, I got a call from New York, and they said that we have several attorneys here who are going to challenge each and every one of your statements. Are you willing to stand by it? And I had said the same thing to them that I said on this show, that the Israeli motor torpedo boats had machine gunned our life raft. And I said, yes, I would. So the show got postponed for about 6 months, and then when it came out, at the end, they allowed some Israeli representatives to the embassy in Washington to come on and basically say that it was an accident, that just to disclaim everything that had gone on. There are so many things that have gone on with this over the last 35 years that our government is deeply involved in the cover-up, and as well as the Israeli government. So that's where it stands.
Well, let me ask you, when was the first time that the movie was, or the actually shown to the United States?
Which one?
Let me rephrase that. When they were done with the Operation Cyanide, the first one of the first complete videos or stories.
Yeah.
When, do you have any idea when it was first shown in the U.S.?
The BBC one was never shown. It's never been allowed onto our network. It's never been shown here. You can order the video online, but you can't see it on television.
Well, I'm going to have to get a copy of that one.
Yeah, it's the cover-up is extremely deep, and I have always, because of what happened to me, I've always been sort of a conspiracy theorist, I guess. The same people, the cover-up of the Liberty is as deep and sinister as the assassination of JFK, and I truly believe a lot of the same players involved. And we will never be told the truth, because our own government is complicit in the cover-up, and we will never know it. I can tell you that right now. It'll never come out. But we hope to let as many people as we can know what happened to us that day. I attended the reunion last year, and to see what this has done to families 35 years later, when you see families who've lost their fathers and sons and brothers, families destroyed, women, wives that are still, their life has been destroyed because her husband's gone, and a very, very sad situation, and yet our government totally turns the back on us when we try to get some information. They won't talk. Our government won't talk to us. And so there's not much that we can do except try to get it out to people that want to hear it.
You said you mentioned one of my magic words that always gets my attention, and conspiracy. There's a whole bunch of them going on, and they will continue to go on in this country when you have people of power and money. What is your thoughts on the conspiracy theory? I mean, you must have one, or probably seen several. Why don't you?
Why the ship was attacked?
Yes.
Well, like I said earlier, I think that President Johnson he'd had pretty good luck with the Gulf of Tonkin. In other words, he pulled that one off, and it came out just a few years ago, that it was a total lie. But he pulled it off and got us involved in Vietnam. Thousands and thousands of more men were sent to Vietnam based upon that Gulf of Tonkin incident. So the theory is that one of your ships be attacked by whatever, and then blame whoever you want to blame for it and go after them. So by sending us over there into this particular part of the world, there was a lot of connection in those years between Johnson and the Israeli secret police, or CIA, whatever they call themselves. And I really think it was something that was probably cooked up between the Johnson administration and the Israeli government to have them sink our ship. No survivors, no messages, period. Oil slick in the Med. We would blame it on to the Egyptians, and then we would attack Cairo. There's quite a bit of the evidence that we intended to do that, but there's so much written on that that it's volumes that we would have nuked Cairo and started World War III based upon the attack of the Liberty, allegedly by the Egyptians. And I think from what I've learned all through my life, this is probably what there's the truth is somewhere in there. And so the whole idea of a conspiracy would be to me the conspiracy probably between two governments to pull something off to go after an enemy, meaning the Russians.
So now going back to the day of that attack, I think it was Ernie Gallo who was on the show, talked about one or several aircraft being launched from either the America or the Saratoga that was actually carrying nukes on it.
Yeah, you know, I had no first-hand knowledge of that, but I have read that also. And that would have been launched, I do believe, from the Saratoga and recalled, and then the captain wanted to send out additional aircraft without nukes to help us, and they were also recalled. And the recall came kind of unusually from the Secretary of Defense himself, McNamara.
So now, if I got this correct, let's make the assumption that this was hypothetical, of course, that the USS Liberty was sunk and all aboard were gone, and it was an Egyptian ship that caused this, or the Egyptians that did it.
Uh-huh.
We attack or nuke Cairo, are we going to be getting even with the Russians over the Egyptians?
No, the Egyptians were partners with the Russians at that time. It would have started the war with Russia, and Johnson figured that we were stronger than they were at that time, and that if we continued for a few more years, they might be equal to us. And the best thing to do would be to strike while you're strong.
Yeah, well, they should have listened to Patton a long time ago, right?
That's right.
You know, Lloyd, you've brought a lot of things to bear here that I was unaware of, first of all, even after having three of your crew shipmates on. But in your personal feelings about the men and the heroism that you saw, is this something that I'm sure you don't go a day, probably even a minute, without thinking about this?
The heroism was unbelievable. I saw, you know, young sailors man 50 caliber machine guns, and we had four 50 caliber machine guns on board for repel boarders in foreign forts. In other words, if you pulled into a fort and there was a riot, that's what we would use them for. They crawled into those mounts and were promptly blown to pieces by the jet aircraft and firefighters that were being shot at from the air, and a tremendous amount of heroism. I didn't see too much cowardice at all, and a lot of, I think, at least with me, I don't think fear was a factor. I just went numb and went into what we'd done for training, and just, I was just in a, through the whole thing, it was like a dream, but I just did what I was trained to do, and that was it. And after it was all over, I had some wounds on my chest from the porthole glass that blew out in my face at the time when the initial attack occurred, and that was the only wounds I sustained. But what occurs, one of the things I failed to mention when we were down below decks and the air attack was still occurring, this is before the torpedo boats came in. When the jet aircraft came over the ship and fired their rockets, I'm not sure what caliber or whatever these rockets were, but they were pretty big. They were put a 6 or 8 inch hole in the side of the ship when they hit it, and it sounded like you had your head in a trash can and someone had a sledgehammer and was hitting the can. That's how loud those were when they hit the steel plating of that ship. It was an unbelievable sound.
And today, how many of your crewmates do you see at the reunion? How many of you are still
there? I think we had about 70 plus there this last time. And it's, I think it depends on where they have them. I think many of them are concentrated on the East Coast, closer to Washington, D.C. So when they have them there, they have more. The last one was in Nebraska, which was kind of in the middle for everyone. But anyway, there are quite a few that come, and many of the lives have been altered forever, especially the family members that lost their husbands or brothers or sons or whatever. It's a pretty tragic type of reunion. It's not a happy reunion.
Well, I really, you know, I just kind of lost the words, you know, after hearing this. Mind you, I had a couple of your crewmates back on in 1996 when I first read or heard about this. And then a gentleman by the name of, I think it was Jim Bourne, he sent me a copy of the book that he did not a thesis, but...
He did a PhD on it.
Right. And I tell you what, it is not only informative, you read this, you think it's science fiction. I mean, it's so hard to believe that this happened. You know, you see the thing about the Kennedy, and you know, we've been taught this whole thing, this story or this lie for, you know, 40 years.
Right.
And when you first heard of it, and the first time I'd heard of it was actually back in the mid-90s. And it took me a while to find, we didn't have computers then and couldn't find so much material. But it was just really hard for me to believe that this actually happened.
The way they said it, did, you're right.
Yep.
And so, the government, our government, is very good at cover-ups. Right? They've got a lot of practice. And they knew from day one. My testimony, well, when we got back to Malta, I forgot to mention, I don't know if we have enough time. Yeah, we did.
Oh, yeah, we got about 6 minutes. Go ahead.
Well, when we took the ship back across the Med, limped across, and went into dry docks, they basically got down to the Court of Inquiry, and they came in, and I testified for about 2.5 hours. I testified as to the captain's medical condition. The captain was in and out of consciousness right after the attack, and I testified to the armor-piercing projectiles that had come through the ship, and in particular, I testified to the fact that they had machine gun our life rafts. Well, guess what? That was all omitted from the Court of Inquiry. It does not exist. So whenever I bring that up, they always say, whoever they are, usually the apologists for the other side simply say, well, why didn't you say that during the Court of Inquiry? Well, I did, but it wasn't recorded. So the cover-up began with the Court of Inquiry and went on from there. We were all warned.
The Court of Inquiry is... The Court of Inquiry is actually whom?
What happens in a Navy incident like this, a Court of Inquiry takes place, and the senior officers come in, we had admirals come in, and they conduct basically an investigation as to what happened. Unfortunately, the only thing that the Court of Inquiry really ever looked at was our negligence on board the ship, and whether or not we had our flag flying, or whether or not we did proper procedures, or whatever. The Israelis were never contacted, and the commanding officers of the other, of the aircraft carriers that launched their aircraft were never questioned. So it's pretty obvious, I didn't know it at the time, that the Court of Inquiry was definitely already stacked at that point. So they never questioned anything about what happened, why we were attacked by the Israelis. It was, in fact, when you read the captain's Medal of Honor inscription when you started the show, And I thought to myself, it was, who attacked the captain? Does it say on that? I don't think it says a word.
No, it does not.
And that's by reason. There's a good reason. They even the some of the markers, I think, at the Arlington can't mention the Liberty. There's a tomb there that has the remains of many sailors in it. And I don't think it mentions the fact that the Israelis did it. It's not there at all. It's omitted. And when you read it, you don't catch it at first. But if you think about it, you think that, I wonder who really attacked the captain, or what did he do? You know, how'd this come about? It's not in that proclamation you read.
Well, Lloyd, we're down the last couple of minutes, and I do want to say that, first of all, I know one of your shipmates has recorded the last three shows, and most likely this show, and they'll be on the USSLiberty.org website, so if a person wanted to listen to them, they can.
Good.
And I just want to say that, you know, my heart and prayers go out to you and all your families, and whether you were told or not, I want to thank you for your service to our country and the sacrifices that you and many of the members of the USS Liberty made. Because if you stop and think about the role the USS Liberty played in that scenario, it's historic. Absolutely historic. Because if that ship would have went down, this planet may not be the way it is today. Not that that's good, but
you're right. If the chief hadn't got the message off that we were being attacked by the Israelis, the world could have been drastically different.
Yes, I agree. Well, again, I want to thank you. It's been an honor to have you on the show. And the next time I'm up in Central California, I'd love to stop by and have a cup of coffee with you.
You got it. You know where I live.
Yes, I do. Give my regards to all your family and all your loved ones, and if you see the members of the USS Liberty, give them my regards. And also, so you know, Gary Brummett sent me this beautiful plaque, and it will go on my I Love Me Wall with all my military stuff, and it says the USS Liberty, AGTR5, has my name on it with grateful appreciation for the many years of support. I want to pass to you and the rest of the crew. Lloyd,
that's great. That's great. I like
good
that.
Good night. Thank you. And we'll be talking soon.
All right. Good night.
This is Sergeant Richard Cabral, your host on Tour of Duty. It's been a fast month. We'll be back in July. If you're looking for us, you can go to the KLD website, and they'll link up to our website, touroftheduty.us. And if you have an email, a guest, an idea, a sponsor, you can always just go to the website. You can contact me there by phone, too, if you'd like. Just go to the website.
You're listening to KLAB, Las Vegas.